All right, well, welcome to the Statesman Journal's Explore Oregon podcast. I'm your host, Zachary Ness, and in each episode, we highlight Oregon's most beautiful and interesting places. In today's show, we're diving into the recent establishments of the world's largest dark sky sanctuary, right here in southeastern Oregon. We'll talk about what it means and how to visit a place famous for its night sky. Before we get rolling, I want to highlight the sponsors of this podcast that make it possible for us to hire and pay our outdoor journalism interns every spring, summer, and fall. Our first sponsor is the American Forest Resource Council, supporting responsible forestry on public lands throughout the Pacific Northwest. Learn more at amforest.org. We're also supported by Visit Tillamook Coast, a land of ocean and forest just an hour from the Willamette Valley that this spring will offer special volunteer vacations, designed for visitors to spend a day doing a stewardship project and another headed out on a Tillamook Coast adventure. We'll have more details on this a little bit later in the show. Finally, we're brought to you by the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department that reminds visitors to leave no trace and buy local firewood when camping at state parks to limit the spread of invasive insects. All right, let's head out to the Dark Sky Sanctuary and the Oregon Outback. But first, here's some guitar music to get us rolling. All right, in today's episode, we are talking about Oregon's night sky, and in particular, the recent announcement that 2.5 million acres in Lake County has been certified as the Oregon Outback International Dark Sky Sanctuary, making it the largest dark sky sanctuary in the world. The size of the dark sky area is about half the size of the state of New Jersey, and it becomes one of the world's largest areas to commit to keeping the lights off so people can enjoy stargazing and astrophotography, while nocturnal animals can catch a little relief. The Oregon Outback is an area we featured a few times on this podcast. It includes areas such as Summer Lake, Heart Mountain, Hager Mountain, near towns such as Plush, Adele, out east of Klamath Falls. I'm joined today to talk about what the designation means and how it might play into Oregonians visiting the area by Bob Hackett, Executive Director of Travel Southern Oregon. Hey, Bob, thanks for being here.
Oh, you bet. I'm happy to be here, Zach.
All right, let's start out with a straightforward question. So what makes a night sky a dark sky? I mean, even in the city, it's still dark at night. You know, we can see a few stars depending on where we live. So what distinguishes a dark sky from what we might see in the Willamette or the Rogue Valley?
Okay, well, you're going right into it. And this is really a kind of a science-y kind of question because, there are obviously astronomers who take this stuff extremely seriously. It's their career. To become the dark sky sanctuary, you can't just say you're dark. You need to prove you're dark. And there's things called sky quality meters. And they are just like a little stud finder. And they live in a PVC housing with an oculus. And they every 5 minutes, they take a shot of the zenith of the sky, day and night, 24/7. The measurement, and I don't even understand it, but they are magnitudes of arc second square of luminescence in the sky. So these sky meters, they can register that. The frame of reference in terms of measurement, there are two things. There's the Bortle scale, which has got 9 parts. Bortle 1 is just pure darkness, and Bortle 9 would be like being in the middle of something that's lit up all the time. The arc seconds readings, 22 is a perfect dark sky. And I'm getting to your question, Zach, about Portland, Rogue Valley, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Dark Sky International breaks down. You can be a dark sky sanctuary if your readings are 21.75 or higher, which is extremely dark.
Yeah.
That's a Bortle 1 sky. For example, and the readings out, we have, I'm monitoring three, one in Summer Lake, one at Heart Mountain, one up in the Warners. There's readings from the Malheur Refuge, Alvord Desert, and those are all coming in at about 21.7, you know, and at 21.77, almost 21.8. By contrast, there's a meter in Southeast Portland, and Southeast Portland is coming in at about 18.75.
Okay.
And so it's kind of like earthquakes. It's exponential. So, you know, and then you drop down all the way to about a Bortle 6 sky when you get into Portland. I live in Talent in the Rogue Valley. And here at my house up Wagner Creek, we're at about 19.7, which puts us at a sort of Bortle 4 sky, which is categorized as brighter rural. And that's because Medford and White City pump out a lot of light. And some of that, you know, can be seen from my house, even though I'm 10 miles from Medford. And so that just sort of gives you the scope of how measured darkness is measured.
Interesting. Okay. So, I mean, it's really dark out in, obviously, the Dark Sky Sanctuary. And, you know, in the city, it's pretty significantly different. Can you just describe, you know, what it looks like, I guess, you know, just from your perspective, like having lived in, you know, more urban areas and then going out and see this, does it feel a lot different when you're out there? Like, is it just, does it hit you in the face?
Well, it hits me in the face. And what it is for me is it's an awful lot to take in all at once, because I mean, there really are so many stars, and what you are used to seeing as familiar constellations are actually still in there, but there's just a lot more light stars in there. And sometimes it's harder to actually pick out constellations, you know, are there, because it can be overwhelming, right? But what you do get because of that is you get an actual texture to the sky. You can actually get almost sometimes, you know, a bit of a coloring to the sky if the Milky Way is really just so dark. You start to see, and you see it in photographs sometimes, you start to see this sort of textured color to the actual astral dust that's in the Milky Way. And so it's surprising, and that's the way I can describe it.
So it almost looks like you're looking up and you can recognize elements of the sky, but it just feels so different that you're just like, wow, this just feels like something else.
To me it does. And at first it's not entirely relaxing, right? Because it's like, holy smokes, there's a lot going on up there. It takes a while to process it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, so in the announcement, it said that the 2.5 million acres of, you know, this is Southeast Oregon, an area known as the Oregon Outback, been certified this International Dark Sky Sanctuary. So what you're saying is they have to be, I mean, the darkest of the dark. Like, this isn't like halfway. I mean, this is like, to qualify, it really has to be like on that scale you were talking about, near the top. Like it, like that's it. Like if you're just a little bit lighter, like you're not getting in. This is a high bar, correct?
You don't even get in. You don't even get through the Dark Sky International Review Committee. Mm-hmm. So they have a review committee for their Dark Sky Places program, and they are international astronomers and dark sky enthusiasts. And so the first piece of data they look at is your darkness data, because you might not even be in the ballpark you think you are. And so, you know, and lots of communities across Oregon, everyone's getting really excited about it. Oh, we want to make sure we want to go for a dark sky place. And the first place people need to start is get yourself a $250, you know, sky quality meter, put it up and download the data and just see where you are. And that will lay out for you what your options are going forward.
Oh, interesting. That's fascinating. I'm curious, when did this get on your radar? Like, when did, you know, tourism start thinking about dark skies as a tourism driver? Because it's been around for a little while, but it still feels fairly recent to think about, like, you know, here's what we're selling. We have a dark sky. Like, when did that start to happen?
Well, I mean, you can look at light maps of the United States. And you can look at a light map from 1950. And yes, there's a lot of light pollution available west of the east of the Mississippi, but much less so west of the Mississippi. When you look at the 2025 projections, you see just an exponential growth of light pollution, and most of that has happened since, you know, sort of 80s, 90s, because LED technology, light technology, it's never been cheaper or easier to light it up. And so the response, the Bortle scale itself really wasn't defined until 2001 by an astronomer named Bortle. And I think the collective scientific response to light pollution and how to measure it is ongoing, because honestly, this is a very recent phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this, like what's the benefit of having this dark sky sanctuary? Like what is the upside here? What are you hoping to accomplish? Like what are those businesses that are in the sanctuary hoping to accomplish with this designation? Is it bringing in more people who are going to come visit, look at the sky, and that's part of their experience out there while doing other stuff during the day? Like, does it just put it on the map? Like what's the upside here?
Well, from the state tourism perspective, it puts Oregon on the map in a big way. Mm-hmm. in the dark sky space. And we weren't there, and now we are. And so, and people who are paying attention are going to see a lot more. You're going to see a lot more state parks come on, Wallowa, Cottonwood. Other stuff is really going to start to come on in Oregon as we go in this space. I think we tend to think of gateway communities, so the Summer Lakes, the Paisleys, the Lakeviews, the Burns. That is where sort of the economic benefit is going to happen for lodging, because the Colorado Plateau did do economic impact studies on night sky tourism. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a no-brainer, but people who are doing night sky tourism, they found they spend three times as much in a community than people not doing it. And it's pretty easy to figure out why. They spend the night, which means they have dinner, which means they have breakfast. And so, you know, to your point, you've been in the Outback, you've done a lot of stuff. There's all kinds of stuff to do during the day out there, right? It's and for people who love remote places, that's why they like to go there. They're not in a rush, but and they like to be out doing things. And this just gives people one more reason to stay just that extra day or two in the region. I don't think we have any economic development, we don't have any goals in that sense, because I think it's a new thing. Mm-hmm. And the capacity for a place like Plush, I mean, it is what it is, right? And so it's not like a lot of people can all of a sudden go there. The reason it's as big as it is, and there are plans to make it bigger with Harney and Malheur going forward. That wasn't a vanity project, really. It was a request from particularly wildlife refuge managers and the BLM. Let's disperse visitors. We don't want everybody coming to one or two places, right? So if we just said, for example, it's going to be, you know, Summer Lake.
Yeah.
Well, then everybody's going to come to Summer Lake and Paisley. And that is not the kind of thing that the Summer Lake Wildlife Refuge wanted, and they're not prepared for it. And you know, they don't have funding. Yes, they have some camping, and that's true with the BLM and the Forest Service. But this is pretty primitive stuff, and they're not looking to become camping resorts out there. And so our job in tourism is to really message this correctly for people to, you know, be prepared. It's going to be primitive camping out there. And there's hotels in these gateway communities where you can have something to eat as well. Mm-hmm. And you pick the way you want to do it.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about the area in particular. We've kind of mentioned it, but you know, if you live in, you know, Portland or Salem, you haven't been to the Oregon Outback, describe it a little bit. What are you seeing? What are you smelling? You know, what defines this area?
Well, okay. Here, if you're in Portland, you're in the Pacific Northwest. Right, you know it. You look around. That's your weather pattern. It's everything. When you head out to Lake and Harney counties, you are in the American West. You're in the West. You're in cowboy country. You're in sagebrush country. You're in the Great Basin. You're not in sort of Cascadia anymore. And Summer Lake doesn't go anywhere. Lake Eybert doesn't go anywhere. the Warner Lakes don't go anywhere. You're in the Great Basin. And so these inland lakes are part of the, you know, the Inland Pacific Flyway, just vast amounts of waterfowl using the whole inland flyway with these inland lakes, huge geological escarpments that are, I mean, Abert Rim is one of the steepest vertical, geologic escarpments in the country. So it's a dramatic, vast landscape. And there's times when I'm driving out there where I spent some time in East Africa, and like sometimes it feels like you're on in the Rift Valley.
Yeah.
It feels like you're on safari sometimes, because there are some paved roads, but most of them are gravel. And you really are out there. And then there's these pronghorn, you know, that are out there. It's a whole different fauna that live out there too.
That's so funny that you mentioned the African savanna when you did that, because I remember being out by the Painted Hills and exploring the Sutton Mountain area right above it. And that's exactly how I thought of it, because there's just vast grasslands, like this undulating plateau, and then like, you know, lone, trees here and there. It's really different. It's so dramatically different that it's wild that it's part of the same state. Oregon is such an interesting state like that, because it has these just dramatically different geologic or geographic areas. So, all right, you know, you've mentioned that there are two dark sky destinations in Oregon. There's the Prineville Reservoir State Park, there's Sun River Nature Center and Observatory. Those are the two that I picked out. And you mentioned the others in Colorado and elsewhere. So, I mean, have those places seen an uptick in interest due to that designation, to that dark sky thing? Like, what have we seen so far?
When you mean in terms of
visits? Yeah, visits, interest, just people talking about dark sky as like a thing.
Well, I'm going back to this Colorado Plateau study. I mean, they were pegging something over a 10-year period, sort of $1 billion of spending in that research area over 10 years. Now that includes Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. right? Major national parks. But I think the point is that these parks have, they're required to get some programming to talk about night sky, but they also find that there's a huge visitor interest in doing this. So yes, I think it does make a difference. And also, I mean, Crater Lake National Park is working on becoming a dark sky park. The Oregon Caves National Monument, they're pretty far along the way for becoming dark sky parks. I even talked to folks in the Cascade Siskiyou Monument up at Hyatt Lake who are, you know, they're thinking about, wow, I think we could be a dark sky park up here. And what comes with that is programming. And so what is going to happen is visitors and Oregonians who go to these places, there are additionally going to be able to have experiences that become not just let's go take a picture of Crater Lake, but let's do a night walk with a ranger or even there's all kinds of cultural overlays. There's a tribal overlay for talking about night skies if mm-hmm. should the tribes choose to engage with it in whatever way they want to. It really opens up a way to talk about this resource that people really just are becoming aware of as a resource, but it opens up a lot of ways to experience a place.
Okay.
And I think that's the opportunity.
Well, I'm curious, at this specific destination that we're talking about, this 2.5 million acres, which is obviously a huge area. I mean, are groups planning to do those kinds of things you mentioned, night sky walks or like programming around it? Or is it just, this is here, you can come and do whatever you want with it? I guess I'm just curious if like places have started either turning it into marketing or turning it into programming.
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, part of our requirement, we have to do an annual report for the sanctuary with Dark Sky International. And for that report, they to keep your certification, they expect to see a certain amount of outreach and education. Mm-hmm. And so you get places like Playa Summer Lake, which was an art residency program out in between Paisley and Summer Lake. They regularly have a dark sky weekend, a dark sky, you know, cohort of artists doing residencies in a landscape. People may know Hunter Nowak, who plays the piano and he moves it around the state.
Yeah.
He's doing a performance in June out at Playa and Summer Lake, and really recognizing this dark sky environment in that way. So, like the Tour to Outback is a increasingly popular bike gravel ride and a street ride cycling on the Outback Scenic Bikeway. And that's out in Adel, and that's in June every year. They're getting more and more folks coming out, and now they'll have a table about the Dark Sky Sanctuary, and all of a sudden people who are coming out to ride, like we were talking about, those daytime activities, they were going to come anyway to ride out there because they love it. But now all of a sudden they're like, oh, well, we need to be sure to go out, to take a step outside in the evening, maybe spend the night, check it out.
Is there any bragging rights, I guess? This becomes the largest dark sky sanctuary in the United States or the world?
World.
Okay, so that feels like, is that a big deal? Like, is that something that Oregon can really hang its hat on? Like, is there competition for that?
I mean, what do you think when you hear that? What do you think?
I mean, the largest in the world sounds pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it's the largest in the world. And that means something. Sanctuaries are designed to be protecting pristine areas of night sky in and of themselves. Yes. And so, yeah, I think it's a big deal.
All right, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. When we return, we'll talk about what's required from local residents and governments to become a dark sky sanctuary. Does it mean limiting building or turning off all your lights at night? We'll also pick out some of the best adventures in the Oregon Outback to do during the day, before enjoying that dark sky at night. So that's up next. Stay with us.
I'm Tiffany Roddy with Roseburg Forest Products. As a professional forester, I was drawn to Oregon by the trees and the vastness of Oregon's majestic outdoors. I'm proud to work for a family-owned, fully integrated wood products company with a deep commitment to our industry and our communities. Roseburg's sustainably managed timberlands are open for recreation and provide natural wood products that help make people's lives better from the ground up. We are proud members of AFRC, sponsor of the Explore Oregon podcast. Learn more at amforest.org.
This message is brought to you by Visit Tillamook Coast. The Tillamook Coast Visitors Association is excited to bring back their Volunteer Adventures program for 2024 that will welcome groups from inside or outside Tillamook County to lend a hand in stewardship programs while also having a good time. One example of an itinerary would be spending one day clearing invasive brush or working on a hiking trail. The next would include something like a guided hike or kayak trip, the type of activity that highlights the Tillamook area and shows why doing stewardship projects is so important. All meals, lodging, and activities are included. The program is designed to offer participants the opportunity to give back to our popular area while also learning the vital role stewardship plays in preserving our natural places. If you want more information or to sign up early, search for Tillamook Coast Volunteer Adventures or email Dan Hag at dan@tillamookcoast.com. Once again, that email is dan@tillamookcoast.com. Our third and final sponsor is the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department that invites Oregonians to explore parks this fall and winter to experience the beauty of those seasons. If you're camping, remember to get firewood from sources local to your destination to avoid bringing invasive insects, such as the devastating emerald ash borer, into parks. This will help preserve the health of Oregon's forests for seasons to come. Learn more about protecting Oregon's ash trees at stateparks.oregon.gov.
All
Okay, well, that kind of leads into my next question, because I'm guessing the people that live out there in the Oregon Outback had to buy into this area. So are they committing to a specific course of action? Are there limits on developments that include lighting? Like, how do you keep that? How do you keep that?
Well, there's a couple pieces to what you just asked. Like, Lake County, you know, in their building codes does have some lighting language about that. Will they update that given the new status? I don't know. I mean, Dark Sky International is always working to provide templates for dark sky statutes and ordinances that help communities get where they want to go. 85% of the land out in the sanctuary is publicly owned, which, you know, 15% is private property. The light management plan, and that is the crux of the whole thing, is the light management plan. It spells out everything about the future going forward with lights in this designated territory. And we have 10 years to get every light on public property 100% dark sky compliant. I think right now we're at about 75%. In 5 years, we need to be 90%. And in 10 years, we need to be 100%.
Okay. What does that mean, though? Dark light compliant? Does that mean turning off the lights at night?
No. It means there are dark sky fully shielded lights that are 2700 that are warm, amber color, or even more orange, no blue lights, of a brightness that is, entirely appropriate and as low as possible, that there's timers or motion detectors in the event that, say, like an ODOT, because ODOT signed this agreement, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have plow yards and work yards and that kind of thing. And sometimes they, for work, they need to light it up. But the important part with them, and they are willing partners, is to, well, you can put timers or motion detect. They don't need to be on all the time. Mm-hmm. They can be on when you're working. And so it's that kind of thing. An important two myth busting pieces. It's not a no light movement. It's a good light movement.
Okay.
So it's appropriate lighting. It's not like we don't want any lights. There's good lights and there's bad lights. And like I said before, unfortunately, bad lights have never been cheaper. In my experience, I haven't met anyone who wants to light pollute. The second piece is that private landowners are exempt from the light management plan. The people who have agreed to the light management plan are all the public agencies and Lake County, because Lake County owns land in the sanctuary. So the Lake County commissioners adopted it too. The outreach to private landholders is really the sort of outreach and education and working, like I said, with the power company to provide resources for people when they're coming to adding a light or they're making a choice about something, that we've made them aware, we've made them educated that there are options here to help keep the Outback Sanctuary dark. And people don't resist it. They don't want to be told what to do. And we're not telling private people what to do. It's really about providing resources and education going forward.
Okay. So it's the public land agencies that are, you know, those are the ones that are sort of bound to have good lights, as you describe it. And you're giving education to private landowners that, you know, if they want to do it, they can have good light. But the way you keep that designation is just the darkness of the sky. Like, does that gets measured?
Yep. That will continue to get measured. There's a light inventories. I mean, every light on public land was inventoried. You have to have a list and a photo and a description of every single light that's in this area.
Okay.
And in 10 years, you know, Dark Sky International wants to look at that spreadsheet and see that every one of them is dark sky compliant. It's actually not really negotiable, and if not, this is the other part. The Dark Sky International doesn't have any regulatory power. They don't have any statute. With the worst thing that happens is we lose our designation.
Yeah, but I mean, but that could be a big thing.
Would be bad.
I mean, you don't want to have the biggest sanctuary in the world and then lose it. So,
and you lose it just through apathy or whatever. And so there's a lot of people who don't want that to happen. And so I don't think that's going to happen, but that's the way it works.
Okay. Well, so in the news release, you and earlier in our conversation here, you mentioned that phrase regenerative tourism, and that's a word I've heard a lot more recently. So do you mind explaining kind of what that means, what the goals of it are, and how it fits into this?
I think a dark sky sanctuary, you can't argue, it's inarguable that the ecosystem is better for reducing light pollution. And I think the kind of work we did will leave Lake County better for the collaborations that will continue to go on. And then the tourism piece of regenerative tourism is, we do look at economic impact. We're trying to create a better life for Oregonians, you know, in sort of the sustainable, impactful way, not an exploitative, extractive way. And so a night sky resource is an infinite resource. If we manage it right, people who choose to engage either in the lodging or by guiding people or, you know, restaurants or any kind of thing, it is a sustainable and long-term economic project going forward, because the sanctuary is not going to go anywhere, and people can calibrate that approach that works on a community level and on a business level for individual people in those communities.
Okay. I'm going to ask a little bit of a sciencey question. Not too much though. Like, why are dark skies good for humans or wildlife? Like, why, like, you know, what do we lose, I guess, with light pollution living in the city? And what do we gain with dark skies, either biologically, philosophically, whatever?
Like, for example, bees are pollinators, right? We know that they're daytime pollinators. Moths are actually nighttime pollinators. And so pollination is going on all day long and all night long. Moths are attracted to blue lights and purple lights. That's why they all congregate around, you know, lights in your house that are really bright. Moths can't see red light or amber light. They're not attracted to it. And so they will continue about their business of pollinating all night long without being drawn into your lights and buzzing around until they die. And so look at the bird strikes in urban areas, migrating birds particularly. I mean, the bird kills in urban areas are just off the charts. And there's a whole movement that Dark Sky International and all kinds of people, Audubon, and turn lights off during migrating season because birds are hitting buildings. Their navigational systems are just completely whacked. They're not used to it. Baby turtles, for example, they've done all kinds of stuff. Like they were having huge mortality in places in Texas and Florida where development was right up to the beach, right? When there were really bright lights. And when baby turtles hatch in a normal environment without artificial light, the lightest place is out over the ocean. There's a horizon light that's different than land light. And they go to this sort of, they instinctively go to the lightest place. Well, when there's a condo right next to the beach, they were just all going to the condo. And they've demonstrated this. They have changed the lighting. They've gone to low lighting, dark sky friendly lighting in various beach scenarios. And now the baby turtles are heading back to the ocean. And so I think the scientific community, I know they are actively engaged in measuring more of this, because I don't think we fully understand the impact on ecosystems. But when you have moths, it doesn't just affect insect life. It affects plant life. It affects bird life of the birds who are feeding on the moths at night. And so there's all this interdependence of ecosystems.
I'm curious, do you feel different when you're in a dark sky area for an extended period? Like, do you notice a difference either in sleep or how you experience the outdoors, or like what's been your experience being in dark sky areas versus, you know, the Rogue Valley?
Well, that our eyes have the ability to see quite well in the dark, and that's no accident because we evolved in the dark. And so, you know, I think of so many 75% of the people in the world, where they live, cannot see the Milky Way. It just, there's that much ambient light. Now it can still be dark, but they can't really see the full on Milky Way. But the point is that your night vision, and it takes 15 minutes, 20 minutes for it to really kick in. Mm-hmm. But people will be surprised how remarkably well they can see at night in the darkness. But it's a kind of vision that they just have forgotten that they have.
Let's talk about like traveling out into this area and just some of the interesting things to do out there. So at the top, I mentioned places like Heart Mountain, Fort Rock, that are somewhat well-known destinations. But what are some of your favorite trips into this area? Like if you were going to recommend, like if somebody, you know, listened to this podcast, read some of the stories about it and were like, oh, I want to give this dark sky sanctuary a try. Like what would you suggest maybe as a daytime, nighttime experience that might be fun out there?
Well, I would break it down to what are your other interests, like we talked about. What are your daytime interests? Okay, so if you are a mountain biker, you've got the Oregon Timber Trail that is starting right in Lakeview. It runs right through the crest of the Warners in this outback sanctuary, and you can go up past Drake's Peak and head on down, and then you can cross over into Paisley and all of a sudden get onto the Winter Ridge. The Winter Rim, and have that experience completely up there as a mountain biker with, I mean, more campsites along the way than you know what to do with. Mm-hmm. All right. So if you're a birder, like you would definitely want to get out to Summer Lake and the wildlife refuge in Summer Lake. And you can either, there's lodging there. There's Summer Lake Hot Springs, you know, which is a wonderful place with cabins and camping. Lake Ebert, I mean, come on, in terms of birding, it doesn't get any better than that. Then go over and then you're into the Warner Lakes as well. And so you can camp, there's BLM sites right out there outside of Plush. And there's all kinds of remote dispersed camping at BLM sites out there as well. And so, you know, that's just two slices that I would take. If you need to be in town, I would stay, you know, Lakeview's got a Best Western. And then in 20 minutes, you're out up by the Warner Canyon and you're in very, very, you're in the sanctuary, right? And great, great hiking trails and walking areas as well.
Yeah, there's great hiking out there. There's canyons. DeGarmo Canyon was one of my favorite out in the Heart Mountain area. There's hot springs at Heart Mountain. There's I think the Oregon Desert Trail traverses some of that too. So that you're right. So your advice would be to pick something that you like already, and then just take the time to step out at night. I mean, is that kind of the is
that's exactly that, right? And maybe you like to fly fish, and so you're in Paisley at the Shewakan, and then you're having dinner at the Paisley Saloon, home to the oldest bar in Oregon, by the way. It came around the horn in 1900, and they got it out there, and it's a great place to go. Yeah. And so, and then there are people who are night sky enthusiasts, right? They go with their cameras and they go with their telescopes. And you know, there's just no shortage of places as to pull up and have that experience at night.
Yeah, I'm curious. Are you like, have you heard about dark sky enthusiasts? I was just thinking about how there's eclipse chasers, where there's people who, you know, chase eclipses across the, you know, the face of the earth, and that's just kind of their thing. Is there a subset of the population that's just like, we love dark skies, we love astronomy, we're going to these dark sky sanctuaries?
There is a subset of night sky photographers who do that.
Yeah.
And so they're definitely a group of they love photography, and they will go to these places to get these kinds of photos that you can't get anywhere else. I think the rise of so many dark sky places with dark sky activities, I don't know that there's chasers in the way that there are eclipse chasers. However, I'm putting my tourism hat back on too. Mm-hmm. I think international visitation, if you have groups coming in from Japan, coming in from China, coming in from, you know, Germany and England, places that really have a lot of lights, the proposition they're already having a great time in Oregon. They've been to the coast. They've been to Portland, right? They're going to Bend. They're doing all these cool things. They've been on a river. To add this night sky experience for so many people in the world is going to be one of the more memorable parts of their trip. And our task now in the tourism world is to help find ways to make that experience available and easy and rewarding for communities that choose to maybe host some more international visitors or people from urban areas that will have one of the more memorable parts of their Oregon visit happen out in these dark sky areas.
Yeah. Well, that's a great way to wrap up. Is there anything else we should know about Dark Sky Sanctuary or the Oregon Outback Dark Sky Sanctuary in particular?
Well, you know, you work with lots of outdoor folks. People need to be prepared, right? So my advice is you got to check in with the BLM Lakeview District website, check in with the Fremont Wanyama website, check in with the Heart Mountain Refuge website. They always have current conditions. People need to help out our land managers, be informed, mm-hmm. Be prepared. It's super remote.
Yeah.
So have what you need. At the beginning, when we were having conversations in small communities, you know, search and rescue doesn't want to be going out to find people. And so you really just want to be conscious of this idea. You're in a very remote place with a very small population. So be ready to take care of yourself, be smart, know where you are, and then give yourself plenty of time to just do nothing but be there.
Yeah.
Okay. And you will be rewarded. Yeah. I guarantee.
Well, the Oregon Outback is a place kind of where time seems to disappear just because it's so large. So I guess I'd add my advice there is bring an extra can of gas too. You never know. And it's good to be prepared for that.
You won't regret having it.
No. All right. Well, once again, I've been talking to Bob Hackett, the executive director of Travel Southern Oregon. Thanks so much for your time, Bob.
You bet. And I really enjoy talking about it. And I hope people head out there and have a great time.
Okay, one final note on traveling to the Dark Sky Sanctuary. Hackett mentioned that for stargazing, it's a good idea to look at the phases of the moon to see when it's at its smallest, just so that there is less moonlight and the stars can really pop out. And obviously, checking the weather for clear skies, another important consideration. All right, well, that's about all the time we have left in today's show. If you like what you've heard, check out our catalog of more than 60 episodes featuring Oregon's most beautiful and interesting places at statesmanjournal.com/explore, along with Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We'd once again like to thank our sponsors, beginning with the American Forest Resources Council. AFRC supports responsible forestry on public lands throughout the Pacific Northwest for our environment, for our economy, and for the future. Learn more at amforests.org. We'd also like to thank Visit Tillamook Coast. If you want to plan a trip out there, you can check out their outdoor recreation map that shows all the places to hike, swim, boat, and camp. You can find that map at tillamookcoast.com/recreation-map. Once again, that's tillamookcoast.com/recreation-map. And thanks to the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, which stresses the importance of recreating responsibly and leaving no trace in Oregon's outdoors. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next time for the next edition of the Explore Oregon podcast.